Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend. This is the book show. It's time to talk about books, the hot late summer reads, books that are in preparation, books that you will want to know about, and some of the favorites of our panel. Our panel, Chris Hickey, is here from the Columbus Library. Chris is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. And Chris Hickey brings us quick picks every time she comes on the show. Those books everybody wants to read. Chris Hickey will tell us how to skip the line. Cassie Rose is here. She is WOSU's book critic. There is no show without Cassie Rose, and her blog, which is important to anyone who loves to read, is thelongestchapter.com. And I am delighted to welcome Robin Yocum back to the show, an author. His new book, The Hitman, is in stores December 2nd, so look for that. It's one of many he's written. Robin has been called a master of the neo-noir thriller. So if you like seat-of-your-pants thrillers and page-turners, he is your man. Welcome, Robin Yocum.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Welcome, everybody. Tell us about The Hitman, your new novel.
The Hitman will be out in December. I wrote a short story for Strand Magazine, which I brought in. Not sure why I brought visuals to a radio show, but I did. That did really well. And it's about an aging mobster in Steubenville, Ohio. All my books, set in Eastern Ohio. And he's outlived his usefulness to the family.
You mean the family or his family?
The family. They've gotten away from the traditional revenue streams of prostitution and loan sharking and gambling and into drugs. And they don't need an old white guy with his skill set anymore. So they've kicked him to the curb. And the FBI knows this. Mm-hmm. So the FBI is trying to flip him. And, of course, the family finds out, and the chaos ensues.
Don't give it away.
No, I'm not going to give it away. Don't want to give it away. But so I did. I took that short story, and I went back, and I bring Angelo Cipriani. He's the hitman. Bring him up from a 17-year-old lackey with the family and show you how he, comes along. And there's a love interest. And the challenge, of course, is making a mob hitman likable to the reader and making the reader want to cheer for him. So, I'm very excited about it. I got a great blurb from CJ Box, who really enjoyed it, and some others. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Got a great blurb from our friend Donald Ray Pollock as well. And he's a big fan.
Donald Ray, yes, I talked to Donald Ray last week. He's good.
The Last Hitman is the latest of Robin Yocum's novels. I'm counting like seven or eight here on the website, but there's probably more.
Well, seven. This will be the seventh novel, and then I have the two nonfiction books.
Do you have continuing characters in your novels, or do they stand alone?
Usually they stand alone. Now, Favorite Sons and The Sacrifice of Lester Yates, I have continuing characters, but those are the only two.
Why Steubenville, Ohio? Obviously, probably you're from there, but is it right about what you know?
And that's exactly what it is. In fact, when I did the Sacrifice of Lester Yates, I actually started that book probably 15 years ago, and I couldn't get any traction. Mm. And I pulled it out of the file cabinet one day, and I thought, I wonder what it was with this, because I got about 20,000 words into it, and I just put it away. So I thought, I'm going to give it another try, because I'm my own best friend. I liked the book. I thought, I'm going to give it a try. I moved the action back to the Valley. And as soon as I did that, the problem was Columbus. I had it set in Columbus, and it just didn't work for me. That Eastern Ohio, I try to capture that time when the steel mills were booming, the coal mines, the railroads, glass factories, the grit and the grind, I call it. And I feel like that's a really... I'm very comfortable writing in that environment. When I had it in Columbus, it was just too, for lack of a better description, too white bread, just too sanitized. once I moved the action back to the valley, I felt like it really picked up steam. And
one thing, you know, if you drive through the valley today, you still see these magnificent courthouses and these great old buildings that were put up in the prime years of the industry there. And you wonder, what was this city like 70 or 80 years ago?
Well, and if you, poor Steubenville, which I love, but it looks like Beirut. And when I was a kid, I would take my kids back and try to explain to them when we had three movie theaters and four, five, and dimes and a big department store. And they look at me like I've got purple horns growing out of my head because it's just hard to imagine that there was so much vibrancy. But there were 60,000 steel mill jobs between Steubenville and Weirton, West Virginia, down to around Wheeling. Plus all the industry that was there that supported the steel mills
and supported the people living and working there.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I try to capture that time when it was a very vibrant place. And
do you have readers? Do you hear from readers who still live in that area?
Yes. Yes. In fact, when I did A Welcome Murder, which is probably my roughest book as far as language, and it talks about the corruption in Steubenville, and the Steubenville Library was the first place to ask me to come back and speak, and I thought, oh man, this could really be bad. But everyone said, oh yeah, that's pretty much the way
it was. Yeah,
it was the Youngstown mob controlled things in Steubenville. The prostitution, the gambling was wide open. So
which city was Dean Martin from?
Steubenville. Their favorite son. They acknowledge it. And it was a time growing up when I could get gambling spot sheets in my high school. I'm not even sure I knew it was illegal. But you could get the football spot sheets, put $2 down, which is all that you could afford when you're a high school kid in 1972. And if you won, if you picked three winners on the parlay, you got $6 back. And one guy would take him up to Lane's Lounge in Mingo and turn him in. And my grandmother, I used to go with my grandmother to Lane's Lounge in Mingo Junction. And the only thing they sold in Lane's Lounge that I remember was newspapers, cigars, and chewing gum. And Leo Lane lived in this magnificent house up on the hill. And I used to think, man, the profit margin.
Money and chewing gum.
Profit margin on chewing gum must be phenomenal. Because, you know, but she was going in to play the daily number.
And listening to you speak, I'm just wondering if you were the 10-year-old kid that the guys would send out for coffee and they'd give you $2 and a pat on the head or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go.
Go. That's right. Robin Yoakam is an author and clearly a raconteur. You're hearing it now. His new novel is The Last Hitman That Comes out in December. Some of his other titles, The Sacrifice of Lester Yates, A Welcome Murder, you said was the roughest one, maybe?
That's it, and the funniest.
I'm buying that when we get off the air. A Brilliant Death, A Perfect Shot, and Favorite Sons. What are your nonfiction books?
The nonfiction was, one was Dead Before Deadline, which was about my years.
Dead Before Deadline.
Dead Before Deadline, which was about my time as a crime reporter at the Dispatch. And then Kathy Kandiski and I wrote a book called Insured for Murder, which was about the Just Sweats case. If people in Columbus remember, it was a murder for insurance scam that Kathy and I covered and turned it into a book.
Do you teach?
I used to. I used to teach at Franklin University.
That's what I thought.
I still do seminars, but I haven't done much teaching lately.
Well, the busy Robin Yoakam is busy writing his books. So we're delighted. We'll come back to you later because I want to ask you things like what does a writer like you read and things like that.
Sure.
Chris Hickey, I want you to give us a quick pick and explain again what a quick pick is.
So quick picks are the hot books. There's long hold lists. And the idea is that you can come into one of our buildings, the book that you are number 568, you walk in, you see the book on the shelf, you check it out, and you jump the line. So a new book, this one is fascinating, and just stick with me because the plot is complex. It's called Moderation by Elaine Castillo, and it is a timely big tech book. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, you might really enjoy this. It also might really upset you. So we'll see where this takes you. So it is a virtual reality legacy romance. And the cover is fantastic. It looks like a legacy romance, but the top part is smeared. It's an interesting cover.
What do you mean a legacy romance?
Yeah, what is that?
So Jane Austen.
Oh, okay.
So yes, like a Jane Austen romance, but this is big tech.
You mean a Jane Austen type romance written today?
Written today, but takes place in the time period and style of Jane Austen.
Okay.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so it's complicated. So William thinks he's part of an espionage thriller involving tech giants and the far right, while Gurley believes that she's an anonymous laborer in big tech. But really, they are in this Jane Austen-like romance. So Gurley is a moderator, and that means she flags and removes the worst of the internet. So really dark stuff. So there is depiction of child abuse in this book. So just know that before you go into it. She's given the opportunity to moderate a new venture called The Playground. And The Playground is a virtual reality theme park based on civilizations of old. So you could be in a medieval crowd. You could be walking the old Paris streets. And it's very vibrant. William is her new boss. And he's one of the co-founders of The Playground. But he's also trying to take it down.
God.
So it's complex.
You need a spreadsheet.
Yes, yes. So Elaine Castillo, she wanted to write a novel about the many custodians that are visible and invisible who shape our online habits. And it takes place, just to make it more complex, it takes place in 2008 during the subprime mortgage crisis, which is morbid. So she looked at Reddit threads to understand what it is like to be a moderator. And some person described it as pumping raw sewage into your brain. So this book is complex, but I think people will absolutely love it. And she describes it as Pride and Prejudice in the Age of Platform Capitalism.
Top that.
Yes, yeah. Platform. So online capitalism. Oh, okay. So, you know, our digital capitalism. Again, that's Moderation by Elaine Castillo. So that is complicated.
And it's a quick pick, though. So obviously a lot of people want to read this book.
Yes.
It's a quick pick.
Yes.
Okay. That is a recommendation from Chris Hickey, who is with the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. And Chris brings us quick picks every time we're on the show. Cassie Rose is here, WOAZ's book critic. We're going to come back to her shortly after a break. Also, Robin Yoakum, the novelist. So stick around. This is going to be a hot and heavy All Sides Weekend book show. Don't go away.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We are back, All Sides Weekend. This is the book show. I'm Christopher Purdy. Chris Hickey is here from the Columbus Library. Author Robin Yoakum is with us. And Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. And welcome, Cassie Rose. Always no show without you, so go
Thank
for
you.
It.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I am going to recommend a book called Misinterpretation by an author, Lydia Zohag, or it's X-H-O-G-A. And this book is on the long list for the Booker Prize, which is Britain's big prize of the fall. It is the equivalent of our national book award in fiction. And the long list has 13 and books on or novels on it. And on September 23rd, the short list of 6 novels will be announced, and that will be the 6 finalists. So I've decided that I'm going to start reading through as much of the long list that I can. And Misinterpretation is one of those books, which I absolutely loved. And in fact, I was mesmerized by it because of the unnamed narrator and also just because of the atmosphere that is created by her, I'll just say her poor decision making, because she makes decisions to help people, but she puts herself at risk and she seems incredibly calm about it. She is a translator and an interpreter. She is Albanian. She lives in New York City. She's married to a charming man named Billy, who is an NYU film professor. The book opens when she is interpreting for a man who is, I forget his nationality, but he's going to the dentist, so he needs an interpreter to go with him. And he becomes attracted to her. He's married, and he also feels very safe with her because he, back in his country, had been tortured. So he wants her to go to his therapist with him and to be an interpreter. And so that's one part of the plot line that's going through. Where it's a bad decision is because there's some similarities there, and you're not supposed to interpret for someone, especially in therapy, when they're, you know, when there's similarities. Another situation is where she helps a Kurdish woman who is a poet who reveals to her that she's being stalked by her ex-husband, who has a cousin following her around. And the unnamed narrator just... I mean, she just takes it upon herself, and she doesn't, it's not a big deal or whatever, but she just sees the man who is the cousin of the ex-husband, and she follows him into a shoe store and goes up and stands beside him and starts flirting with him and gets herself into a situation that's very risky. And the whole time I'm reading this book, I'm thinking, why are you doing this? Aren't you worried? Aren't you concerned? Which is exactly what her husband is thinking, because also some of the people show up in her apartment. The whole point of this book is this idea of, you know, what we do when we help people, how far do we go? And there's nothing in this book, though, that makes you frightened or that would crosses the threshold into being like a stalker, killer kind of a thing. Not at all. It's just normal life. But her husband is, he leaves because he can't take the stress of it. And then she goes to Albania to visit her mother. And all of everything connects, all of whether it's the young man who's gone to the dentist, it's the poet, and it's the husband, and how she has helped people and how they have ended up being networked together in a way she didn't realize it. It's really a book that you want to read. You aren't frightened or compelled or whatever. It's just you want to read it because of that unnamed narrator and that gentleness, that calm that she has, that she just keeps going and doing what she's doing. It's really a very, very good book.
Review the title and the author for us again. And also, just if you could go back and remind us again about the Booker Prize.
Sure. It's called Misinterpretation, and the author is Ledia, L-E-D-I-A, Zoga. X-H-O-G-A. And it is, one of the nominees for the Booker Prize. It will be announced in November. And the Booker Prize is Britain's top award. It comes with a big purse, as they call it. And this is where it is a top novel, the best of that is published in Britain by, and it's in English and published in Britain. So actually, there is one novel on the long list, which is by Susan Choi, Flashlight, which is published here in the United States. But because it was published in Britain, it's on their long list. That's also a very, very good book. So it's just it's like our National Book Award. It's a top book in fiction. And it's very fun to read their long list and their short list. It comes like a really good reading list.
Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and if she tells you to read a book, read the book. Trust me, you won't be able to put it down. This is All Sides Week in Books. I'm Christopher Purdy, and Robin Yoakum, our writer. One thing I always ask writers when they come on the show,
sure.
And it's an old question, but it engenders good discussion, is what is your process? How do you write your books?
So, you know, I start with what I call a launch point, and it's just that little germ of an idea that makes me think I could wrap a book around this. Once I do that, then my next step is what I call, and these are my terms, just a brain dump. And I just think about the book and I'll take notes. I don't worry about spelling. I don't worry about grammar. It's all idea generation. I won't put words on page one until I know what words I'm going to put on the last page. I have to know how the book ends. I feel like I can draw the roadmap to get there as long as I know where there is. And it'll take some detours and you run back and forth, but I've always got that
point in the future that I know where I'm heading.
Do you change your mind ever?
Yes.
Do you change the ending sometimes because something does does it take over?
I haven't, like in Favorite Sons, it was supposed to be a book about a wrongful conviction. It was supposed to be The Sacrifice of Lester Yates. But these four boys kill another kid, and then they conspire to keep it a secret. Well, when I wrote those four chapters, I became more interested in those boys than I was the guy on death row who was wrongfully, he had to stay there for a while. but I had to quit writing because now I don't know how my book ends. I had to create a new end to the book and take it from there. So things, it's fluid. It's a fluid process, but I have to have that kind of that dot on the map to get there. Once I start writing, I do a minimum of 500 words a day. And that's usually
kind of a lot, though, really, when you think about it, every
day. It is. Yeah. And if you're sitting down and writing.
Yeah.
Now, as Chris and I were talking earlier, my kids live in Virginia, Michigan, and Tennessee, so I spend a lot of time on the road. The last book, The Sacrifice of Lester Yates, I did the entire first draft using the voice-to-text app on my phone.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It was like in the car.
Yes. Driving down the road, having a conversation with the voices in my head. And
great.
I would email it back to myself because the hard part, I don't want to say it's the hard part, but the most important part to me is to capture the ideas when they're fresh in my brain. And so I would use that.
You say that many of your novels are set in the Steubenville area or in the Valley area.
In the High Valley.
Do you... is that area always fertile for you?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. And comfortable. As you said earlier, you know, you write what you know.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I grew up at a time where every man I knew went to work with a hard hat in one hand, a tin lunch pail in the other, including every man in my family. So I just feel like it's an area that I can mine for those first generation immigrants that came to work in the mills and the mines. And the Valley has almost become a character for me.
Right. Yeah.
In itself. Yes.
Robin Yocum is an author. He is talking about his novels, the setting of his novels, and his newest novel, The Hitman, which comes out December 2nd. And Chris Hickey is here giving us another, maybe less complicated, quick pick.
This one is complicated. I'm sorry. But it's excellent.
It.
Excellent. This is Jason Mott's new novel. It is called People Like Us. And he won the National Book Award for his book, Hell of a Book. So this, if you read that book and enjoyed it, there are several characters that make their way into this book. So Jason Mott set out to write a memoir and instead turned it into this work of fiction. So it's about two authors. They're both American Black men, and they're both Jason Mott in a sense. So the first one has just won a major award and is on tour in Europe. The second man, and this man he's never named. He doesn't have a name. The second man is on a book tour in America. He's known only as Soot. That's a nickname. And he is touring the country in the wake of a horrible school shooting. And so both men are experiencing America, one from the outside, one from the inside. So that's very much a theme in this book. This book is very much about gun violence and grief. So the author who is touring Europe, he's given an offer by a French billionaire. Like, if you stay here and write, I will make you a millionaire. But the catch is you can never return to the United States. And
why would he want him to do that? What's in it for him?
We don't really know. You have to read. It's complicated. You have to read to find that out. But he... you know, he's like, it's a no-brainer. Why would you want to go back there? And it's complicated for this author. And when he goes to Europe, he sneaks a gun with him on the plane because he's being hunted and also possibly haunted by a man who said, I'm going to kill you. And so this man shows up in the oddest times. It's very strange.
Javert.
It's
Oh, yes.
I do think there's a similarity there. The man in America, Soot, is lost a child, lost a daughter to gun violence. So his grief sits alongside the grief of the people that he's interacting with. So this book is just, it is unflinching. It is gut-wrenching at times, but his writing is just so beautiful. And I just want to share just a piece of it where he writes, there should be a word for the ability to stop crying about past pain, even though it is still in you. There should be a word for living. Yes, that's it. There should be a word for continuing to live when a part of you has died. There should be a word that sums that up. And the longer you live, the more that word should become a part of you. Because the thing of it is, every day that the person is missed feels longer, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing you can do to share the long, beautiful days that they are not part of. There should be a word in the English language for admitting the person you love is not there, and yet you've had a good day. There should be a word for admitting to yourself that some of the good things in life did not die with them. So this is...
It's a
beautiful book, and I can't stop thinking about it. And I think readers this will be a good book club book because there's so much to unpack here.
I wonder what turned him from writing a memoir to turning it into a novel. What that, you know, if there's someone who's done an interview with him or there's an article about that.
Yes. He said that he discovered there are things he just didn't want people to know. He didn't want to put all of that out there. So that's why shared things about himself through these characters.
It's called People Like Us by People Jason Like Mott. Us. It is a quick pick from the Columbus Library. And you will find on Facebook, thanks to Chris Hickey, all of the books of the titles we talk about today and links to get them in the library. And
yes, there it will take you to, it's shared on WOSU. It will take you to a list that is in our catalog. So you can reserve the books. You can have them sent to your favorite location.
One-stop shopping here on the book show on WOSU. Cassie Rose, what do you have for us? What's next on the Booker list?
Actually, what's next is a book called, or a novel called One Boat by Jonathan Buckley. I absolutely loved this book and was so thrilled to see it got longlisted on the Booker. It is not complicated at all. It is very much of a reflective kind of a novel, but it's one you just get totally drawn into. One is because of the setting, which is at a small town on the Greek coast. And a woman has arrived there. It's her second visit, but she's arrived after her father has died. 9 years ago, she came to the town and had discovered it because her mother had died. And so she is now returned, and she's looking to reconnect with everyone. And what happens in the book is that the first visit and the second visit get interlocked in terms of the stories about with the encounters of people. And one of those situations is, for example, in the present, she's walking downstairs in the hotel. She sees this table in the breakfast room and remembers a worried businessman sitting there 9 years ago who she ended up having a walk along the bay and having a strange conversation with him. And here she was grieving her mother, and he was grieving. And he tells this story about how his nephew was murdered outside a pub. And just a punch in the face, and it was the wrong place, and he ended up dying. And how his sister, the man's sister, just didn't deal with it well. So this businessman, and he loved his sister. Well, he then reveals that he knows the murderer got 2 years, and he says, I know where he lives, and that's why I'm here. So what they have another conversation, and he says to her, I want you to know that I think I'm going to kill him. And so there's a fascinating debate that goes on between the two of them, because she's an attorney, and this debate of, are you really going to achieve something? What will this do? And when I say it's a fascinating debate, it's because this is what this book is about. There's a lot that's explored because this main character, Teresa, is there to think through a lot of things. And so But back to this moment, she essentially says to him, whatever you do, leave the weapon in the car. That's all she can say. But that is a very sly plot line that the author has sort of put in the book. You've got to watch for it because it connects throughout the rest of the book and into the present. Meanwhile, she is remembering also about her mother having a conversation with her about saying that there is an explanation for everything. And her mother was a physicist. And she says, but how can there be, you know, with the trillions of stars? So we get caught up in this inner world of thinking of her. And that's a big part of the book because you are on this coast, near on this bay, there's a palace in ruins, you know, on the mountain. She's meeting with people. She's reading Homer's Iliad. And yet you get these deep thoughts. They're not intellectual. She's very accessible. But at the end of the book, and I'm not going to tell you how that plot line works out, but at the end of the book, you know, she leaves. And I thought, I don't want to leave. I don't want to leave this town. And I don't want to leave how she is thinking through these things that we think ourselves, because that's the magic of it too. It is almost like her thoughts, which are in italics throughout because she's keeping a notebook, are almost like our thoughts. They are so accessible. So it's really a beautifully done book, and I absolutely loved it.
So place is critical in this book.
Yes, it is.
The Greek town and the Greek island. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. This book is published by Fitzcarraldo Editions.
Fitzcarraldo.
I love this publisher. It comes out September 16th here in the United States. It's Fitzcarraldo is a British publisher. And they have these signature books where their fiction is blue. They're all paperbacks, blue with white print, and their nonfiction is white with the blue. And they're called, they have French flaps, if you know what that is.
And Cassie Rose just held up, for those of us on radio, a blue book with white print. It's called One Boat by Jonathan Buckley. It's been, it's one of the 13 on the
Booker Long list.
Booker Long list right now. Mm-hmm. This is The Book Show. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We're going to take one more break. Don't go away.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We are back for our final segment on today's All Sides Weekend. This is The Book Show. I'm Christopher Purdy. We have Cassie Rose here, who is WOSU's book critic. Chris Hickey is here from the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Library. And author Robin Yoakum is with us. His newest book, The Hitman, is published on December 2nd. It's his seventh novel. Now, Robin Yoakum, one thing I also wanted to ask you is, for example, if you were teaching a writing class or whatever,
sure.
or if I came to you and I said, what does a writer read?
Very good. Well, I have an eclectic list, and I do read a lot of history, that interests me. I don't read a lot of mystery and suspense, with the exception of James Lee Burke books, who I think is one of the best writers in the country. But I just, right now I am reading I'm listening to audiobook, The Bright Sword by Lev Grossman. I'm about ready to give up on it. I'm about 3 hours into it, and it's the narration is Old English. Mm-mm. And I keep hitting the rewind button because I can't understand what they're talking about. So, but I just finished Cleat by James Lee Burke.
Talk about him, because you mentioned him. What? Who was he?
He writes a mystery series out of New Iberia, Louisiana, with a character named Dave Robichaux. And Cleet is Dave Robichaux's partner. He's one of the best characters in crime fiction. He is so good. Burke, in my opinion, is one of the best combination writers and storytellers out there. Just really good. Now, he does a series out of Texas, The Holland Family, and I just finished that one book. It said, Don't Forget Me, Little Bessie, and it was really the first one of his books that just didn't resonate with me. Didn't do it for me. I much prefer the ones down in Louisiana. The Wager by David Gran is on my list to read, and a book called Sea of Darkness, and it's about the Confederate submarine Huntley, which they found in Charleston Harbor. Well, it's probably been 20 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Clive Cussler launched an expedition and found that. That's on my list. And I just finished Demon of Unrest, about the bombing of Fort Sumter, which is a very good book and gives you a lot of insight of the run-up to the beginning of the Civil War, which I think if you read history, you tend to think it all occurred after Lincoln won the election, but it actually had occurred 30 years earlier and was part of a bigger movement that just
festered for a long time before it boiled over.
Exactly.
Now, The Hitman is coming out in December. What's generally the time lag between you finishing the work and the work being published?
So once I finish the book, it goes to my agent, and she takes it out and sells it.
Yeah.
Right. So generally speaking, it's never less than a year from the time that we sign the contract till the time it hits the shelf. 12 to 14 months is a good time frame.
I ask you that because I'm wondering if what you're working on now.
So I've got one that my editor has that I'm. And again, like I said earlier, I'm my own best friend. I'm really excited about it. It's about a sex slave I will tell you, I tend to handle that very lightly. I don't get too deep into it. I make sure you understand what's going on, but without a lot of the graphic details. The detective who is trying to solve the case. He has that. I am working now on the first novel I've ever tried to write from a reporter's perspective. I was with the Dispatch for years, and I've started this book two or three times and put it away. Didn't feel like I was getting the traction. You know, if I'm not excited about a book, then the reader's going to know that. They're going to see that I mailed it in. But this time I'm determined to finish it. It's just written from it's about a serial killer, but written from a reporter's perspective, and I hope to have the draft finished by the end of the year.
And Robin Yoakam also has a wonderful website where you can learn all about his books, and you're going to be doing a lot of appearances coming up.
Got about 20 of them.
You're going to be at Gramercy too, aren't you?
Gramercy on December 2nd, the day it's released.
All right.
Wonderful bookstore.
Yes.
And then I'm headed back to Steubenville the next day to do something at the library in a little bookstore.
I hope they give you a parade, for God's sake.
Well, I would think a parade would be nice.
I think so. Robin Yoakam is with us today. And Chris Hickey says she's got a whimsical and fun quick pick for us.
Yeah, this one is not a quick pick, but I just want everyone to know about it. It is called The Enchanted Greenhouse by Sarah Beth Durst. So this is the second book in her Spell Shop series. So in the Spell Shop, there is a character who's a sentient spider plant. His name is Kaz. So he's created by a woman out of loneliness. And in this world, only this elite class of sorcerers can do magic. So she is found out and she's turned into a statue, a sentient. She knows what has happened to her and has moments where she is awake inside the statue.
Oh, that's
and can
an
see.
Opera.
Yeah, right. It could be. Yes. So, Sarah Beth Durst worried about this character. Her name is Terlu, and she thought, well, this cannot be her only story. So she wrote a story for her. So Terlu wakes up on this island, you know, cold and alone, not understanding what has happened. And it's an island full of enchanted greenhouses. And there's only one other person on this island. His name is Yarrow, and he is the gardener. So the sorcerer that created these greenhouses has died. All of the other people have left, and Yarrow's been trying to keep things going by himself. But the greenhouses are now failing, and he begged for a sorcerer to come and fix. Well, she's not a sorcerer, but they sent her. Her descriptions of these greenhouses, because they're never ending and they are beautiful. And I mean, that could have just been the whole story, is just the description of the greenhouses. And I would have stayed for the whole thing. So you've plenty of that, and it's wonderful. But she, there's a bunch of other plants that are sentient plants that have fallen asleep. And she knows what it's like to be an inanimate object and how awful that is. So she figures out how to wake these plants up. And it is
but
really,
she can't wake herself
up.
She's awake. She's already awake. So she once she gets to the someone has transported her to the island and done a spell to wake her.
Release
up. So
her.
She's been released. She's no longer a statue. I'm sorry. Okay. She is not a statue, and she's going to try to wake up these plants. It is a love story. It is all of these plants just have these delightful little personalities. So cozy. This is cozy fantasy with romance, and cozy fantasy. Like they're feel good fantasy mm-hmm. novels. There's going to be a happy ending, and it's just beautiful. I could just live in those greenhouses. I just wish she would write. It could be 900 pages.
Listen, cozy.
I would have been there.
Cozy is great. I'll take it. Cozy is wonderful. That's a great genre that you talked about that last time mm-hmm. you were here. We had a whole riff on that, which
yes,
is very interesting. That's called The Enchanted Greenhouse by Sarah Beth Durst. It's a recommendation from Chris Hickey of the Columbus Library. Not a quick pick, but it may be now because you just...
It's wonderful.
The way you mm-hmm. talked about it. And I take the liberty of recommending a book if nobody minds. Mm-hmm. I've discovered a writer called Bruce Holzinger, and his latest book is called Culpability. And I just finished it. It was an Oprah pick. Thank you very much. And it is a novel that really incorporates AI and the good and bad aspects of AI. In terms of a car crash, the car is driven by the son of the family who was texting while he was driving. And there are all kinds of repercussions. And it's a real, you don't know who or what to blame. Is it technology? Is it people not paying attention? Is it the parents? I mean, it's a very, very riveting read. And it's one of those books that when it ended, I was sorry it ended because I just wanted to keep going. So I recommend Culpability by Bruce Holzinger. And I'm reading now another one of his novels, which is about getting the kids into that school, into the best school. And it's, you want to take these kids away from these, as far from these parents as you can. You want to put them in a bus and get them somewhere else and put them in a wonderful camp
and
somewhere.
This is a novel.
This is a novel. Okay. Yes. And I forgot the title. Like it's like City School or something like mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. the word school is in the title, Bruce Holzinger. So a little recommendation, if you don't mind, from myself. Generally, I'm just supposed to introduce everybody and shut up. So, Chris, no, you're not Chris Hickey. You're Cassie Rose, and you're W.O.'s book critic.
Yes, and those two sounded like really good books.
They are.
I don't know that author.
Holzinger. Bruce Holzinger.
Okay.
What do you have for us, Cassie Rose?
I have a book of nonfiction. It's called The Village of Ben Suk, S-U-C, by Jonathan Schell. And it was originally an essay in The New Yorker in July of 1967. And it's about Ben Suk is a village in Vietnam that was evacuated by the American military because they needed to neutralize an area in South Vietnam, and which was much of what was going on in the early stages of the war. But one of the I want to talk about Jonathan Schell. I mean, he came to this. He was in Tokyo. He was 24 years old and he was learning Japanese. And he had graduated from college where he had studied East Asian history. And at this time in 1967, there were less than 100,000 troops, American troops in Vietnam. And a year and a half later, when he was leaving Japan, there were more than 300,000. And he thought he was going to go over there and just take a look at what's going on. And he embedded with the division that was involved in this Ben Suk operation, which was Operation Cedar Falls, by his college newspaper pass. So he wasn't even formally of the press. It was his college press pass, in essence. So, and back then, at that point, the military was not paranoid yet about the journalists coming over. So what the book is, or what the book and what the essay was, is that, and he writes very compassionately, but sticks with the facts so that you can have your own reactions. So he doesn't sway you in any way. And it's not about, it's not combat or whatever. It is literally about the evacuation of this prosperous village that, that had to take all their farm animals, all their farm equipment, and then what happened when they were being resettled. He's very much connects with the American soldiers that were young and just following orders. They were told, you know, shoot to kill, and the enemy, and they didn't know how to identify the enemy. And then also about, he connected with the villagers, how the plan to evacuate was just immaculate, but then once they got them to, you know, the area where they were settling them, the Americans had not really thought it through, not like they probably would have today. It's only about 125 pages. I just picked it up because I like to read about the Vietnam War. I have a whole shelf about it. And so I just wanted to bring it up because I think it's very interesting. And if you're a New Yorker reader, you're going to know the style.
What's the author's name again?
It's Jonathan Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L.
Is he still alive? Do we know?
I'm
just curious. Because
No, he died in 2014.
And I'm also curious, I mean, if it was a New Yorker article, because very often they are book length and they're always worth
reading.
Right,
but it came out in 67.
Why now? Why publish it now? Is it my...
Write this book now?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Well, it's New York Review of Books.
Yeah, which we love.
So,
they
come, and for some reason they, you know, felt that this was, I mean, in the introduction, it doesn't say why they did, but in the introduction is fascinating.
No, I don't question. I'm just curious. Yeah.
That's, why not? It's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't know why they decided that. Now, he wrote The Fate of the Earth. Many people might remember that book that came out that was years ago. I remember reading it. But anyway, I also want to mention that if you want to read journalism about the Vietnam War, Dispatches by Michael Herr, H-E-R-R, is the book to read. I will tell you, you will not be able to put it down. It is the classic. You can go online and you will probably see it has a bazillion 4 or 5 stars on it. When I read that book several years ago, it was 2 o'clock in the morning before I could get myself to put it down and go to bed. So that one I would absolutely recommend that should be read. Dispatches by Michael Herr.
Recommendations from Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. What's on the blog right now? TheLongestChapter.com, your blog.
I've written about the Booker long list, and plus I also have some other books there. I have a thriller listed that I've been reading, as well as a book that I started that's coming out in September. It's nonfiction about ghosts.
And Chris Johnson, our producer, thank you so much, looked it up and found that the title of the book is The Gifted School by Bruce Holzinger, the one that I'm reading now, which, again, you'll want to rescue these children from trying to get into the school and maybe burn it down. But anyway, it's a very, very compelling read, very thoughtful read. And his other book that I liked very much was Culpability. That is his latest book. Everybody gets one more minute. Chris Hickey.
Okay, R.F. Kwan's new book. She wrote Babel. This is Katabus. It is about feuding PhD students who follow their professor's soul into the depths of hell so he can write them letters of recommendation. If you like mythology, tons of mythology, you'll love this book.
We'll love this book. Robin Yoakum.
The Last Hitman, December 2nd. I have a very compassionate, likable hitman if that's possible.
He's the elderly man, right? He was sort of, you were talking about. Right?
He's 69. Yeah, he's age 69. Yeah, I know. Well,
am I?
Yeah,
hello.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You write what you know.
Yes.
So, I'm excited for it. And
sounds like a Netflix series, too. I hope it gets...
From your lips to God's ears, but yeah.
Sounds like a good series as well.
Yeah.
And Cassie Rose.
The Dancing Face by Mike Phillips. It's an art heist of an African mask that a history professor wants to repatriate from the British Museum back to Nigeria.
And that is the book show today, All Sides Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy. I thank my guest, Chris Hickey, from the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Robin Yocum, best wishes for the new book.
Thank you
so
much.
We look forward to reading that. You'll come back and tell
Absolutely.
Us more about it.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
And Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. My thanks to senior producer Marcus Charleston, to student producers Chris Cochran, David Stein, Isaac Huck, and Colin Simpson, with video production by the Ohio Channel and board operation by our own Chris Johnston, who makes sure that we are on the radio. Thank you all for that. Thank you all for listening. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning Edition on 89.7.